Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with economist Robert Polin about inflation, its causes, its effects, possible solutions, where we stand right now, where we might be going in the year ahead. Think of this episode, if you will, as Inflation 101. That's what I'm doing. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, science, health, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com. The podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. It occurred to me in preparing for this episode, this question: was America so traumatized by inflation in the 1970s and early 1980s, which I recall was a result more than anything else of OPEC, the fossil fuel producing nations, declaring its independence from U.S. domination and raising fossil fuel prices? Was it so traumatized by that that it rejected Jimmy Carter, elected Ronald Reagan, ushered in neoliberalism, destroyed labor unions, allowed wages to stagnate for 40 years, and today has the Federal Reserve ignoring the latest trends, the latest, that is, month-to-month trends in prices, and kind of ignoring the trends in profits entirely, to raise borrowing rates so high that we could be thrown into a recession? This time around, I see today's inflation, which is global, not domestic, and which is higher in many other economies than in the U.S., primarily due to dislocations of the global pandemic and the lockdowns that occurred because of it, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which really affects global energy and food prices. Yet, as I said, the Fed seems intent on responding by sacrificing the personal economies of workers and their families to rein in inflation in Wall Street's economy. So today I'm calling on economist Robert Polin to school me and you on the subject, and I'm looking for answers to a number of questions. I'll throw out some of the questions I hope we get around to, though I will let the conversation go where it will, and we may not touch every base I'm going to mention here. What is the definition of inflation? Is there agreement on that definition? Is it accurate? Is it meaningful in the real world? What is the history of inflation and our responses to it? What does it cost us? What are the solutions? What do they cost us? I understand it to be the primary goal of the Federal Reserve to strike a balance between inflation and full employment. Am I right? And am I right in observing that the Fed seems to consistently err on the side of tolerating unemployment in order to deter inflation? What are the particular causes of our current inflation? Am I right in the ones that I put forward? What are the latest trends that is not going back a year, but going back the last few months? Are things shifting? How should we assess the Fed's response, the Federal Reserve Bank? Does it even have the power or the tools to deal with the current causes of our high prices? What is the role of windfall profits and price gouging on the part of corporations in inflation and in battling inflation? And are there other better responses we could be taking? Okay. I realize that's a lot to hope for. And as I said, I assume the flow of the conversation will dictate how much we actually cover, but let's give it a try. Robert Polin is Distinguished University Professor of Economics and Co-Director of the Political Economy Research Institute, PERI, Perry, at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His several books include The Living Wage, co-authored with Stephanie Luce, Back to Full Employment, Greening the Global Economy, and The Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, co-authored with Noam Chomsky and C.J. Policronio. He's also authored and co-authored a number of reports aimed at moving things forward in the real world, not just academic reports, but things that can be in the toolbox of people who want to make change, from creating living wage statutes to the economics of Medicare for all, and including the California Climate Jobs Plan. Welcome again, Robert Poland. Freeform, a world that just might work.
Thanks very much for having me on.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, February 1st. First of all, how are you? We last spoke in August 2021, and in that previous interview, we were joined by Dave Campbell of United Steelworkers Local 675, and we talked about the California Climate Jobs Plan, which I find very exciting, and I find myself mentioning a lot when people sort of are bemoaning, wait, but are we going to get anywhere? It's a big problem it deals with, but I have found myself, I think about, of the various conversations I have on the show, which ones come up when I'm in the real world, and that is one that comes up for me a lot. I invite listeners to find that episode on their favorite podcast platforms or at my site, and look for California Climate Jobs Plan or Robert Poland. So can you briefly tell us about the plan, about this work that you're doing with various states, how it happened, what you learned, and kind of an update on maybe where we stand, and then we'll jump into inflation.
Well, yeah. First, thanks again for having me on. It sounds like from the way you summarized that you pretty much know everything I'm about to tell you anyway. So I think, it'll be quite easy to go over things. And it was great being on the last time with Dave Campbell, somebody I have a huge amount of respect for as a visionary labor leader, a labor leader who is trying to combine the saving the planet with the well-being of working people, especially the workers whose livelihoods are dependent on the fossil fuel industry.
And let me mention one thing. I said Dave Campbell is with the steel workers. The steel workers represent a great deal of the oil workers in Southern California.
That's right. And so, the study that we did for California was an overall program to get California to achieve its emission reduction targets, which is zero emissions by 2045, and to do it in a way that defends the well-being of workers, including especially the workers that are now dependent on the fossil fuel industry. So where is the progress? First of all, there is some progress nationally with the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. So we are talking about inflation. It's called the Inflation Reduction Act, but actually the Inflation Reduction Act is primarily concerned about climate issues. I guess that was just a moniker that they had to put on to satisfy Senator Manchin in West Virginia.
All right.
And that law, which passed, 8 months ago, on the one hand, it is not, in my opinion, it's not close to being adequate to move us onto a stabilization path. On the other hand, it is dramatically larger than any other climate initiative ever undertaken in the United States, and for that matter, pretty much anywhere. Maybe, there's some comparable programs in Europe, but nothing bigger. So that is a major step forward. And then what I noticed just in the past week, in fact, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal that a lot of the new investments and the support, the subsidized investments in clean energy, are being targeted at red states, which is a very smart thing to do, because these are the states in which at least the politicians, I don't dare speak for the people living in those states, the politicians say, the Green New Deal, it's garbage, it's a Marxist conspiracy, and it's not addressing the needs of the people in our state. Well, what this is showing, quite the opposite, that this is actually a real substantial driver of economic opportunity in red states as well as blue states. So that there is progress. And the more people realize that, the further along we can go. Now, on the specific issue that we talked about with Dave Campbell, which is protecting the well-being of fossil fuel workers through just transition programs, there is very little progress, including in California. There's discussions, there's very high sounding kind of resolutions and so forth. But in terms of the actual implementation of viable initiatives, we aren't there yet. One of the things we tried to show in our study was that putting down a truly generous, robust program that oil refinery workers can support, because it will not entail massive loss of well-being on their part, which is the only kind of program that really deserves the term just transition.
That's right.
It's not that expensive, including in California, including everywhere. I mean, I also did one for the whole U.S. economy. And you've
done other separate ones for a number of states.
Now, including West Virginia, including Senator Manchin State. And, you know, what we found is, just take the average for the whole economy, to give a program that would guarantee new jobs, that would guarantee wages would not be cut, that would guarantee the retraining as needed, and so forth, at a generous level. You know, it's as compared to the overall economy, it's less than 0.01% of GDP. So, you know, a bare drop in the bucket. And that's to give everybody, you know, everybody that loses their job in the fossil fuel industry a guaranteed new job at their same pay, at least. Their pensions would be guaranteed. So this is all a matter of will. It's not even a matter of money. It's a matter of will, and it can be done. And with the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act, I'm at least hopeful that people will start to see that this kind of initiative, a real climate program, also will engender benefits for people's well-being.
Yeah, one of the numbers that stuck in my mind was you said that the average oil worker, we're talking specifically California, this was the California plan, makes something like $135,000 a year, while the average job they might get in clean tech might make $85,000. Well, that's $50,000. But in the plan, and this number that you were just talking about, that 0.01% of GDP, they would be subsidized to their oil worker level for the first 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah. Now it's not forever, but
right. So it would
imagine what's happening is once, if you can use that carrot to move the transition, then other forces will come into play.
And yeah, Dave Campbell's support and the support of other unions is critical here. That the, you know, the 85,000 that people on average now make in clean energy and sectors, that's not a fixed number. That's a snapshot for today. That can go up, and especially if you have union organizing, and you know, you have a subsidized, government subsidized programs that has to establish labor standards, good labor standards, so these jobs can become high quality, well-paying jobs, just as the fossil fuel industry jobs. Fossil fuel industry jobs were not good jobs. They were jobs that the unions fought to make them good jobs over decades. And now we have the opportunity, especially because of the subsidies, and just like in construction, when you have a public project, publicly subsidized project, you have higher labor standards. It's called Davis-Bacon laws. And that would be the kind of framework that through which we can establish the clean tech jobs as being equivalent in quality as the fossil fuel jobs.
Okay, a couple of things that I want to say, and then we'll move on. One is that one of the things struck my eye immediately and why I reached out to you and Dave was I liked the arena, I liked the findings, but also that this study was at least partially or wholly financed by the unions.
Yeah, wholly.
And that's been true in other states as well.
Well, it wasn't always the unions per se, but in some states it was the unions. Other states it was some combination of environmental and pro-labor NGOs, non-governmental.
Yeah. No, I mean, but I think when people nowadays assume that the whole country is functioning like the Beltway, or the whole country is functioning like cable news, to find that it isn't, to find that there are people working together because they are in the real world, the problems are in the real world, it means the solutions have to be in the real world, I think is something people can't hear often enough these days.
Couldn't agree more.
Okay. So let's move. And thank you for the work you're doing. You know, even if the progress hasn't been made in the several months since our talk, there is something that exists now that when someone is at all serious and thinks the objection of jobs versus economy, green versus jobs, is still real, there's something that someone can say, no, here.
I think the idea has really certainly, you know, and again, the Inflation Reduction Act, in my opinion, is far from adequate. But the basic premises around which it was framed, and to his credit, the way that Biden pushed it was to say this is good for jobs.
Yeah.
And he's proving it. And he's proving it in red states.
And that's actually most of his, if I'm not mistaken, most of his little visits around the country now, especially to red states, Kentucky or West Virginia and so on, is to say, look what's happening. There is a green future for red states.
That's right. there's West Virginia. Yeah, you name it. Yeah.
Okay. So inflation. Just to start off at the baseline, what is the definition? Is there agreement on that definition? Is it accurate and is it meaningful?
Well, the basic idea of inflation is an increase in the general level of prices. It doesn't refer to an increase in one price. So if we're just, say, talking about the price of oil going up, that we would not call that inflation. If everything other price is going down or staying flat. So inflation, by definition, refers to a general increase in prices. Now, in reality, not every price moves at the same rate, either up or down. So, yes, we have different rates at which prices move. In the 1970s, as you mentioned, the Organization of Oil Producing Countries, OPEC, did succeed in raising the price of one thing, oil, by 400%. That is a massive, massive price increase. So, you know, if oil was $1 in day one, and day two, it's $4. That's what we mean by a 400% increase. And because oil is such an important, critical thing that people consume and businesses consume, that 400% increase in oil pushed up a lot of other prices. And that's what we would call inflation. Now, there are issues on how exactly we measure this. And in principle, if you think about it, you say, okay, well, because we want to understand the overall movement of prices, we have to think of a basket of goods that people are going to buy. Now, then once you get into the details, and I actually teach this stuff to PhDs, what goes into the basket? How much do we weight each thing that's going into the basket? And there are differences, and there are issues that you need to sort through. And two basic, and these are actually the technical terms that are sometimes used in the formal literature. We can think about so-called democratic basket and a plutocratic basket. And a plutocratic basket, you would say, okay, let's see everything that everybody buys, and just divide it up equally, and that's our basket. That's plutocratic because rich people buy a lot more. And so the things that they buy get overly weighted in the basket. A democratic basket would say, let's look at the average household and see what the average household buys, and we'll call that our basket. So in principle, we want to go more with the democratic basket, define inflation. In practice, there's complications. So there are issues, but that's generally what we mean when we say, what is inflation? It is we're looking at a basket of goods and services, and when the prices associated with that basket of goods and services when they go up.
And in this case, if we agree that it seemed to be energy and food, which of course is the energy we use. I mean, it's all energy in a way, but energy and food were the two areas that seemed to send things rising. And those are in the Democratic basket, I would say.
Yeah, they're weighted more in a Democratic basket because rich people don't have to spend as high a proportion of their overall income on food and energy. They have to get their houses warm, they have to get the lights on, they have to buy food, then they have a whole lot more money to spend on whatever, super yachts.
Right.
But that's not the case for the average household.
Right. By the way, article in today's LA Times that our natural gas prices, which of course is what most people use for heat, and we've had a cold Southern California winter, and it's been a very cold winter around the country, they went up 300% January over last January. They're expected to fall a significant amount, maybe two-thirds. But my wife walked into me yesterday, into my office, and had our gas bill. And she said, "Is this real?"
Yeah.
And
right.
I said, "Yes, it is." Yeah. Okay, so that's inflation. In terms of the history, I pegged the trauma and the resulting policy to the 70s, early 80s. My assumption is that it's happened probably cyclically over time. Did that signal a sort of change in how people perceive things and so on, that particular set of inflationary actions back then? Or has the history been sort of, as I say, just kind of a cyclical thing and so on?
Well, I don't know how far back you want to go in history. But, you know, it's a very good question, because really, until basically World War II and the post-World War II era, there were, of course, bouts of inflation in the United States and other countries. But periods of inflation were basically matched by subsequent periods of deflation, of general prices going down. And so that if you look at a very long historical trajectory, you don't have much movement in that long-term trend in prices.
Mm-hmm.
Periods of high inflation matched by periods of declining prices, deflation. Since World War II and the aftermath, we really have never had any sustained deflation. We've had changes at the rate at which prices are going up, inflation, but we've never had sustained periods of prices going down. And the reason for that is straightforward. In the aftermath of the Great Depression and then World War II, the role of government and economies became much bigger in order to protect ourselves against another collapse comparable to the Great Depression. So anytime there is any kind of trend towards a economic downturn, severe economic downturn, government policies, to more or less degrees, but government policies intervene and set a floor on the downturn in the economy. And so we'd never really experience deflation. That is exactly the case as what's happened during COVID. You're absolutely right. You know, the fundamental cause of the inflation that we experienced the last 2 years is tied to the lockdown with inflation and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But it is also the case that had we not had massive government interventions in the United States and in all the other advanced economies, we would have experienced deflation. It was the government spending that did prop up the economy. And if you want to say, okay, that's why we have inflation. Yes, to a certain extent, that's true. But every time one says that, you should say, well, thank goodness, because otherwise we would have had an economic collapse comparable to, if not worse than, the 1930s. I mean, after all, in the United States, in February 2020, right before the COVID lockdown, the unemployment rate in the United States officially was 3.5%. By April, right after the initiation of the lockdown,
unemployment was 2 months.
Yeah, was at 14.5%. Depression level. And it would have just spun out like that, as it did in the Great Depression. It was only government intervention that prevented it. So we did have inflation. There's other factors, as you've mentioned, and we can get to. But it's true that the government intervention under both Trump and Biden, government intervention did prevent an economic collapse. And that did set a floor on the economy and thereby avoided a deflation.
Very good. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with economist Robert Pollan. And we're talking about inflation, its causes, effects, solutions, where we stand. And you can learn more about Robert's work at the website of the Political Economy Research Institute, which is at UMass Amherst. And that would be, the website would be PERI.UMass.edu, PERI.UMass.edu. I have here a quote from Larry Summers, who, of course, is a big voice in all of this in terms of inflation and so on. And he says, wages are the ultimate measure of core inflation. Most costs go back to labor. How true is that? And how true is it specifically now dealing with this inflation and this economy?
So on average, labor costs, wages constitute 65-70% of all costs on average. That does not mean that they are the cause of inflation, certainly not the current inflation. So if we want to talk about the role of wages in the current inflation, I think, you know, we first have to frame it talking about historical framing. As you mentioned, the average non-supervisory worker in the United States is earning on average today basically the same that they earned in 1973. That's 50 years on average. And these are official statistics from the U.S. Labor Department. I'm not making this up.
Right. And I think we let's just in case someone was in their car listening to this and they kind of glanced away. Could you say that again? That basically non-supervisory labor.
Yes.
Is making what they made in 73,
yes.
Which is basically when that last.
And that was when we had the first oil shock. And so now, yeah, and, you know, this is measured, talking about inflation, after controlling for inflation. In dollar terms, it's higher, but after you control for what you can buy with a dollar, it's basically the same. Roughly speaking, it's about $53,000. That's what the average non-supervisory worker made in 1973, and that's what they make today.
And one other point that I want to make is that that has not always been so. From World War II until 1973, yeah, workers' wages were pretty much in step with the economy. As the economy grew, so did wages. And yeah, their place in the economy sort of remained solid. And that was the era of the great American middle class.
So I will adjust what you said slightly. So the period that you're referring to, so from World War II, post-World War II, up to, yes, the early 1970s, average wages rose faster than average productivity, meaning productivity refers to the average amount that a woman or man is going to make over the course of a day, their production.
What they achieve for the company they're working for. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then the wage reflects how much you get paid for what you produce in a day. And there are a lot of issues with how accurately these things get measured. But, you know, roughly speaking, the average living standard was rising relative to the overall economy. And that meant we were having incrementally a more egalitarian society, greater equality. It's capitalist, yes, but is a more equal variant of capitalism. So to give you one basic indicator, around 1970, if the average worker is making, roughly speaking now to keep it simple, the average worker is making $50,000, the average CEO made $1.5 million, okay? So that's a big difference. That's a 20-fold increment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the average worker today, again, in round numbers, is making still $50,000, but the average CEO's pay has gone up tenfold, from $1.5 million to $15 million. So if we want to talk about, you know, really the fundamental things that have changed in this society, and maybe if we really want to get this far-right movement, what are they so angry about with elites? Well, if you had to pin it on one thing, that's what I would pin it on.
Inequality.
The massive increase in inequality.
Just to remind people, we said that wages have basically been stagnant for 50 years.
Yes.
CEO and stock market, and the wealthy are the ones who own most stock. People will say, oh, the stock market is democratic. Yeah. But most of the stock market is owned by the wealthy. Both of those, their salaries and their the stocks they own have gone up enormously.
Tenfold.
Yeah.
So now we're going to look at our current moment and say, the problem is wages are going up too fast and that's causing inflation. First of all, technically, that's not even true.
Right.
Which we can get to. But even if it were true, the context would be, okay, wages are finally going up a little bit after 50 years in which they haven't gone up at all. So that's the context. Now, what about the issue is, are wages responsible for the current inflation? Well, wages did go up a little bit coming out of the COVID lockdown. Wages have gone up 4 to 5% on average. But prices on average have been rising faster. So even with a 4% wage increase, you are worse off because prices over the past year went up by, say, 7.5%. So you are worse off by 3.5%. If your wage goes up by 4% and your basket of goods goes up by 7.5%, you're worse off.
Right. So, and that seems to me it makes two points, Robert. One is, okay, let's not think that workers are the cause of inflation because they're actually trailing inflation. But let's see, that 3% difference, that's where I'd look for the cause of inflation.
Exactly. So where is that coming from? Well, you already raised the basic structural factors, which are coming out of the COVID lockdown and then the war. And what has resulted from that, during the COVID lockdown, there was literally a lockdown, a global lockdown. That means things didn't get produced. So, you know, to take one very important prominent example, we'll get to oil in a minute, but computer chips supply was heavily squeezed. So what that meant, for example, one important example here, I mean, is that new cars couldn't get built at anywhere near the rate that they had been because there's about 2,500 computer chips in the average new car now.
Wow.
You can't build them. So when you couldn't build new cars, and so there's a supply shortage of new cars, which meant that if people wanted to buy new cars, the prices would go up because demand was greater than supply. But even more so, people moved increasingly into the used car market. And then used cars, which they're already there. They're cars that are already there. Used car prices last year were going up by 40%. Why? Well, because there was the shortage of new cars. There was a shortage of new cars because you couldn't build them because of the shortage of computer chips. So this is what has been going on in the aftermath of the COVID lockdown.
Can I jump in one more point here, which is that it seemed to me, reflected in the Southwest Airlines debacle recently, right, that their method of trying to stay so tight to spend as little as possible to produce their service caught up with them. Some of that also happened in creating those shortages, right? There was lockdown was one factor, but the other was that we're used to only producing what we need. And when demand fell, we didn't need as much, so we stopped producing them. And then when demand began to arrive, we had to gear all up again.
Exactly. So yeah, look at the airline. Let's go back. If we can remember back 2 years ago, February 2020, pre-COVID, people flew on airplanes. That was a, you know, integral part of how our economy operated. And then, you know, by March 2020, no one was getting on an airplane. We may not like the airlines, but they were faced with a massive crisis. They had big overhead. They had costs. Yes, they had workers. They had employees. And they just didn't have any customers, like zero. So they contracted their operations, which effectively means they're contracting their supply. Now, to get back to the normal level of operations, you can't do that at the snap of a finger. And on top of that, the losses that they experienced during COVID meant that they were going to be excessively cautious in trying to return to normalcy. And so, yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, they, Southwest did it worse than other airlines. But basically, that's what was underlying what happened there with Southwest. Now, what also happened, though, okay, oil. Okay, the oil companies also took massive hits during COVID because, yeah, if the airlines aren't buying fuel, then you know, they're losing a massive, a huge amount of their market. And then people aren't traveling by other means as much.
Right. So they're not commuting to work.
That's right. No one's going to work. So then we open the economy back up. And then the oil companies had stopped producing. We open the economy back up and there are oil shortages. So now the companies, they're not stupid. They see this. So they jack up their prices. So what really is not just the supply shortages, but it was the capacity of the big corporations, starting with oil companies, to increase their prices to exercise their monopolistic market power. And so the price increases, as we just talked about, were much higher than the increases that workers got in terms of wages. And so the Biden administration recognized this by initiating this idea of a windfall profit tax that, and we've all read about it now. Over 2022, the big oil, U.S. oil companies earned $200 billion in profits. Now, are you going to say that we want to cut workers, we want to raise unemployment, but we're not going to do anything about the massive profits these companies earn from gouging, price gouging? They knew they could get away with it, and they did.
And I think the thing there is that you had a situation created by extenuating circumstances, huge ones, pandemics and wars. But then the tendency of business to take advantage of increased demand, which is what happened when the pent-up demand following the lockdowns happened, to not only make what they're making with this new demand, but to raise profits. Katie Porter has that famous viral video of her with her whiteboard in a House hearing saying that it had been determined it was 40%+ of it was in profits. Is that pretty much agreed on that, you know, if not 40%, that a significant amount of those price increases are profits, not labor, not supply? And why doesn't that matter more? Why doesn't Jerome Powell talk about that? And the media had a session with Powell recently. I don't remember how recently, but the headline sticks in my mind, in which he was not asked one question about profits.
You know, I can't really answer that so much. I mean, you've very graciously referenced our institute here, Perry. We had a conference on this just in December, and that was obviously a very strong focal point. So it's not like that nobody ever talks about it. We talk about it a lot, and then we have these, you know, technical papers, but then we had non-technical summaries in the American Prospect, which is a very good publication and widely read by policy wonk types in Washington and so forth. So it's there for everybody to see. It's not like, you know, any kind of deep, dark secret. But so why is it that the Federal Reserve keeps saying, you know, the labor market is still too tight? You know, effectively saying we have to raise unemployment. Why do they say it? We can get into the politics. Analytically, to say that is simply wrong. It's bad economics. What we should be saying is, yeah, what we have to control is the windfall profits, the massive price markups, the monopolistic power that resulted coming out of the COVID lockdown. Now, on top of that, yes, of course, you have the effects of the war. Russia and Ukraine both. Russia is a major supplier of natural gas and oil. Ukraine is a major and food, and Ukraine is a major supplier of food. And so, yeah, you're going to have a war that's going to create shortages. And those shortages means that we have a mismatch between overall supply and demand. And when there is more demand than there is supply, that will tend to raise prices.
What have we left out? What should people know that we haven't touched on? I've got a few other questions, but from your perspective.
No, go with your questions.
What other solutions could we be doing? And my guess is that some of what we could be doing, other than the Fed just continuing to raise rates with a serious potential of a recession out in front of us, what other tools are there? What other things we'd be doing? And I know some of them would be more long-term. And I will say one of them is we could have an actual antitrust policy in this country. Even Ticketmaster and people who don't pay attention to anything else, the folks who buy tickets to concerts would agree with that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm one of them. My granddaughter said she was dying for me to get her tickets to Taylor Swift. I was online trying along with 19 million other people and failed to get tickets. I had to tell her and disappoint her. She'll get over it. But first thing, I think, is to recognize that actually inflation is already coming down quite a bit. So if we look at the numbers that are reported in the press are looking at, say, last month relative to January of 2022. And then what we've been hearing over and over is 12 months relative prices. But what's happened in the last 6 months is really inflation is basically at its long-term trend. It's at about 2%. People don't realize that because you keep getting this news that inflation is at 6.5-7%. It is if you measure the last 12 months. But if you look at the last 6 months, it's at 2%. If you look at the previous 6 months, it was at 10%. That's why it averages out.
Right, of course.
Yeah. So that's the first, and that's really critical because if we're saying the cause of the main driver of the current inflation was the COVID lockdown and coming out, well, we are coming out now. So these supply shortages that built up as a result of the COVID lockdown are getting cleared. The supply chains are getting restored. And many people said, well, that would happen. It is happening. So we aren't seeing any kind of serious inflationary pressures on average at present.
So let me just jump in for a couple of things. One, the real-time for this conversation was 6 months ago, but leave that aside. But it seems, I mean, the metaphors are obvious, right? This would be like putting a Band-Aid on something after it's healed, or putting, you know, dieting after you've lost all the weight you want to lose. But it's serious because it affects the families of this country and the world.
Yeah. So in that series of articles that I mentioned in the American Prospect, my colleague Jim Boyce has a very good, simple article that everybody should read. It's very easy. The point is very simple. And he's just saying, how come we're measuring only this year on inflation as opposed to things that are happening more recently? He said the equivalent is, if you, like right now at this very moment sitting in Amherst, Massachusetts, it's 20 degrees, okay? But what if you said, what's the temperature in Amherst? Well, the average over the year is 52 degrees. Well, who cares about the 52 degrees over the last 12 months? Now, you may say we don't just care about the fact that it's 20 today. Well, let's look at, you know, the last 2 weeks or our forecast for the next 2 weeks. But, you know, what is the appropriate time frame for identifying our relevant period, our trend? And for this, you know, massively important, as you said, decision on what to do about inflation, it is critical to recognize that the driver was the COVID lockdown and the war. And at least the COVID lockdown factor is working itself out. And so to respond to an effect that has already worked itself out makes no sense.
That seems to be, you know, huge. In other words, when I'm asking you what are possible solutions to this current inflation, one of the things is, well, is there that much current inflation? And as you're saying, it's back down to kind of its normal average.
Yeah.
So what should I be asking instead of that? Should it be, what are the solutions to kind of the last year's thing? Or should we just say, if they would just look at the current trends, we'd be asking other questions and solving other problems?
Well, that, but I think it's certainly fair to ask. And that these other types of solutions, as we've been discussing, taxing windfall profits, antitrust, putting a cap on monopolistic pricing power, markup power of big corporations, the energy sector. If we transition to clean energy, we will get rid of this problem of the oil companies having all this power, which of course is why the oil companies fight it. And it isn't totally irrelevant that this law, the Inflation Reduction Act, is called the Inflation Reduction Act, because transitioning to a clean economy, clean energy economy, does mean lower costs for energy, because to generate a kilowatt of electricity from solar and wind right now is half what it is for coal or natural gas. So naturally, we don't have the supply.
How long has that been true? That's within the last few months, or?
No, it's been true for a couple of years.
Wow. And
again, I'm not making this up. This is coming from the U.S. Energy Department. In fact, it came from the U.S. Energy Department when Trump was in charge of the U.S. Energy Department. So these are real numbers.
By the way, I like the way we've looped back to the clean tech jobs stuff at the start. It does all fit together.
And, you know, the other part, in my opinion, of building a clean energy economy to eliminate emissions is to raise efficiency standards. So how far you can go with your car, or how, you know, if you have an electric heat pump, how hard it is to keep your house warm or cool. Those efficiencies also mean lower costs, because you're consuming less energy to get the same result.
What about housing?
Housing is the single biggest factor in the official consumer price index. It's about 35%, one third of everything in the consumer price
index. That basket we were talking about.
Is housing. There are issues in how you actually measure housing, but we'll put those aside because I know we're running out of time.
Yeah, we are.
So if we talk about the things that matter in housing, heating oil, electricity for lighting, these are the big factors in housing. Transitioning to a clean energy economy would stabilize those prices. Now, it obviously doesn't happen overnight. This is things that's happened over years. But if we recognize that the inflation bout, this huge inflation bout that we've experienced, is basically over. And so the solutions that really work with time, we now have the time to implement them. And so that we can build an economy that is more resilient against the kinds of shocks that we experience due to COVID and the war.
Okay. And one other thing I heard there was that perhaps housing, and I think we've seen this happen a little bit, but perhaps housing, like oil workers, there needs to be some transition thinking, right? In other words, maybe people need subsidies while we're increasing the store of housing available. Right now, supply and demand says housing's rare. So prices, whether it's rents or buying, are high. Perhaps there has to be some subsidization there while we transition to a bigger house stock.
Well, you know, one of the biggest forms of subsidy that came out of the, you know, the U.S. economy in post-World War II was exactly for housing, because we had controlled interest rates. The interest rates were capped by law, and that was really the basis for building the housing stock. Effectively building the American dream suburbs with subsidized housing. Now that goes away. And so, you know, when we had the financial crisis in 2007 and 2009, the major driver there was turning housing stock and mortgages into speculation. So instead of having a controlled, regulated market for financing housing, we have a Wall Street driven casino determining how much people pay for housing.
Okay, I think we got to bring it pretty much to a close. I'm going to mention one thing, which you don't have time to even reply to. An interesting article out of Robert Reich in the last couple of days, in which he said that, you know, the taxes of the wealthy used to help pay for the government. Now, the government deficits created by lowering the tax on the wealthy means that the government has to borrow. And you know who they're borrowing from? They're borrowing from those wealthy people. Right. Whose taxes went down. So now instead of paying taxes to support the government, they are being paid interest on the loans they're making to the government. And it's just like you go, it's kind of mind blowing what's happening.
Yeah, that's true.
Robert, thank you so much for today. This was, you know, getting down into the weeds a bit, bouncing around, but that's what's going on now. And I really appreciate it. You can learn more about Robert's work at the website of the Political Economy Research Institute, PERI.UMass.edu. And that American Prospect was their most recent issue.
Well, it's online.
Okay. Thank you, Robert Polen.
Okay, great talking to you.
Okay. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, 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 or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement, in which I tell you who we're going to talk to, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to 10 articles to flesh out that conversation, email me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y. @mac.com. Or you can also sign up at my website to subscribe to the podcast, most of the podcast sites at which it occurs, or at my site as well. Check out the podcast. It goes back many years, includes Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer, you name it. You can also follow me on Twitter, @McNallyTerrence, McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and all of you. Most importantly, please share this podcast widely.